the talk today is on how should socialists organise. So Corey Oakley is our speaker who's going to be introducing the topic, who's very well positioned to be discussing this. He's the secretary of the Victorian Socialists. He's on the national executive of Socialist Alternative. And if you're interested in reading some of his writing on the subject, he's also the author of What Kind of Organisation Do Socialists Need?, which is in the fifth edition of our journal, Marxist Left Review. So please make Corey feel welcome.
Thanks, I feel welcome now. Okay, well, any discussion of the kind of organisation that socialists need, I think, has to begin with at least some look or assessment of the different elements of the situation in the world that we face. And I think the first thing to say about that is to look at and talk about the just profound crisis that we see in the world capitalist system today, a crisis that is economic in the sense of, you know, every year more and more wealth concentrated in the tiny top echelons of the ruling class, where living standards for the vast majority of the world's population either go backwards or are stagnant. There is a crisis in the system of imperialist competition, where now, what are we, 30 years after the end of the Cold War, we're starting to see, again, the serious prospect of major military conflicts between the great powers, in particular between the United States and China. And we see an ecological crisis, which is unfurling with, in some ways, incredible rapidity that is, over the next generation, almost certain to completely upend the social and economic structure of our world, displacing millions of people, causing crises, across the globe, and I think, raising the whole prospect of the future of humanity on this planet, putting that into question. And we have ruling classes around the world that are ruthless and determined to pursue their own interests, the profits of their ruling classes at the expense of anyone else. And I think when you look at that situation, you can only conclude that only a revolutionary overthrow of the entire existing society, that is the only realistic prospect that humanity can be saved, that liberation in any sense for the mass of the world's population can be won. And really, any idea that you can reform the system a little bit, that you can tinker around the edges and so on, I think is, in today's world, and I think it's been the case for a long time, but particularly when you look at the crisis confronting us today, is utopianism of the most extreme order. So I think the case for revolution is not the topic of this talk, but is absolutely clear and manifest. The second thing I think we can say about the world today is that the capitalist class, the ruling classes of the United States, of China, Australia, the European Union and so on, their power and the power of capital that they back up is, in spite of the fact that they're in disarray in many ways, is of an unprecedented strength in many regards. There was a discussion yesterday that I was at. Jeremy Small gave an excellent talk about revolutionary versus democratic socialism. And in that, it was raised a question about, well, a lot of people say, well, the world's very different today to what it was like in 1917, the Russian Revolution, and so on. We can't just have the sort of, the same approach that socialists had back then. Well, I think the world is very different today. And one of the key reasons that it's different is that actually, if you look at that revolutionary struggle in 1917, actually, the ruling class that the Bolsheviks and the Russian working class confronted and overthrew was immeasurably weaker than the ruling classes of the world today. It's a backward society with a weak and somewhat imported ruling class, absolutely nothing like just the monstrous power that's in the hands not just of the capitalist class economically, but also of their state apparatuses. The state apparatus of the United States, the main imperial power in the world today, dwarfs anything that's ever existed in history in terms of its military apparatus, its apparatus of surveillance and state repression, its ideological apparatus and so on. So for all that we can look at the United States today and see weakness and chaos, I think it's crucially important to remember that their state, their machine for maintaining the power of the ruling class is the strongest that has ever been existed in history. I think another element of the situation we face today is obviously the rise of the far right that there's been quite a lot of discussion about at this conference. And, it wasn't too long ago that when socialists talked about, you know, the danger of the rise of fascism that we were sort of laughed out of court, that it seemed like, you know, I remember 15, 20 years ago going to anti-Nazi demonstrations and the general response of most people was like, yeah, the Nazis are stupid, but, you know, like, and bad, but, like, we don't really need to worry about fascism. Well, today, I think that, you know, that has entirely changed. Across the world, we're seeing a revival of a movement that is channeling the very real and legitimate anger of people against the system, against the hardships of their lives, into, you know, the most vile reactionary politics. It's about, you know, stomping on anyone who can be put below you. And then the other element that I think is important to understand is the historic weakness of the revolutionary left and the workers' movement in the world today. That it is now 100 years since the Russian Revolution that I mentioned earlier, but that was also the period where around the world, particularly in Europe but elsewhere as well, mass revolutionary workers' parties were established in country after country to try and take on the system. Since that period, at the end of World War I, we have seen defeat after defeat after defeat for the revolutionary movement, starting with the rise of Stalinism and then, you know, a whole series of events that have left today and for a long period of time now, you know, revolutionary socialism on the margins of the workers' movement. And then added to that, and partly related to that, we've seen a very long-term decline now of working-class organisation and struggle, particularly in the Western world, where you have a situation today in you know, countries like the US and Australia and Britain, where strikes rates are at an all-time low, where organisation is at an all-time low, and so on. So that is an incredibly negative situation. So overall, the picture of the world today, you're very hard-pressed to paint a very pretty one. But there are signs of hope, and I'll talk about some other ones as well. But I think one of the things that is of extreme importance is that into the space, and as a result of the crisis, particularly since the economic crisis broke out in 2008, we've seen, it took a while to come about, but we've seen the revival of a reformist socialist or social democratic movement in a number of countries. And particularly important, I think, that they've revived in both Britain and the United States, where the idea of socialism has been so removed from the body politic for so long. So I think, you know, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn to the leadership of the Labour Party in Britain and of Bernie Sanders' rise to challenge Hillary Clinton in 2016 and again running for the presidency this time is extremely important in starting to get established in society that there is some alternative to the brutal neoliberal consensus that has governed governed politics for at least the last 40 years. That really, until that, the only alternative was the alternative of fascism and the far right. We're now seeing some of the things that Sanders and so on say and that Corbyn say, that we need to blame the billionaire class, that we need to get governments to actually fund and actually support the kind of infrastructure for people that can improve people's lives. All of these things are a quite important break from, you know, the mantras that we just need to privatise everything, that we need to let the market rule, and that we trickle down economics, and that, you know, if we just make the rich richer, everyone else will catch up eventually. That this is a really important break with that. And I think now we face the real prospect, or the possibility at least, that by the end of next year, we may have Bernie Sanders in the White House and Jeremy Corbyn in 10 Downing Street. That would really be, I think, an important way, a major shift in the whole framework of world politics, analogous in a way to what happened in the other direction where Thatcher and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan both came to power in the US and Britain in, what was it, 1980 or thereabouts. So I think, you know, the challenge that Sanders and Corbyn pose, the fact that they raise the idea of socialism to not be just some marginal thing that groups like us talk about, but that is something talked about by millions of people, is of huge significance. But I think it's also vital to see that the challenges posed by Corbyn's Labour and by Sanders, that they're fundamentally inadequate to the task that faces us in terms of any idea of transforming society. They, both of them, present what is on the one hand a radical break from the past 40 years, but on the other hand, a very mild program of reforming the capitalist system that we have. You know, lots of the things that they talk about, you know, $15 minimum wage, this would be a great step forward. And a whole series of, you know, I think what does Corbyn want to nationalise the posts and the railways and I can't remember what the other one is. You know, good. steps forward, but nothing like what is necessary to solve the fundamental crisis that faces human society on a global scale. But I think the other problem, aside from the sort of the mildness of the programs that they put forward, is that neither of them, as essentially electoral challenges to the status quo that's existed, neither of them present any strategy or any methodology or any means to actually challenge the power of capital, to actually challenge the power of the ruling class, and in any sense to overthrow them. And that's partly just because the projects are so electorally based. You think of what, you know, Sanders is doing now in the United States. It's running around trying to organise to win a primary. Now, there's nothing wrong with running around trying to organise to win an election, but the things that they're doing, the way that they're mobilising people, the way that they're training the activists to do that, this is not going to help you when you need to come up against the power of the US state machine. It's not going to help you, you know, working out ways to actually organise an alternative to the ruling class's way of controlling society. You know, nothing remotely like that. And so socialists, I think, need to relate to these phenomena. And I'll come back to how, but I think we need to start off by being clear that, you know, while they're an important step forward, they in no way show how humanity could be liberated in any fundamental sense, or the crisis in capitalism can be overcome in any fundamental sense. So, as I said, I'll come back to how we relate to those, but I think I want to talk about the other major phenomena that's been manifest in the last period since the economic crisis, and that is, of course, the great Arab revolutions that flowed throughout the whole of the Middle East, starting in 2011. And people have, I think, largely forgotten about those. They're only 7 years ago, until quite the last few months and weeks, really, where we've seen an incredible revival of that struggle in Algeria and Sudan, and once again raising the question of a much more fundamental challenge to the way that society is organised. And I think those revolutions in 2011 were defeated in the short term, although I think the process is very much still unfolding. But nonetheless, they gave a hint and a vision of the kind of struggles that are necessary to take on the status quo and take on the capitalist system. Rosa Luxemburg famously said that every step forward of a real movement is worth a dozen programs. Well, I think we can say that every revolutionary upheaval that has shaken an Arab capital in the last decade is worth 100, Jeremy Corbyn's and Bernie Sanders, in terms of providing any vision of how society could be changed. And I think the other thing that's crucial in terms of the question of how socialists organise is to see that the revolutionary movements that emerged in 2011 are very much the terrain on which we need to discuss that topic. What we need to talk about is what basis should socialists organise should be talked about in terms of how would they intervene, how would they affect, how would they relate to upheavals like that. Because the reality is that the great tragedy of the Arab revolutions was that they were defeated, that they were not beholden to any political party or another to begin with, but precisely because there weren't revolutionary organisations and socialist organisations that was strong enough to be able to intervene and lead and direct and help cohere those struggles, they went down, at least in the short term, to defeat. So the question of socialist organisation, in my view, comes down to, how can socialists build to intervene in monumental struggles like that when they erupt? And I think there's a number of elements to how socialists can intervene into those struggles. The first one is that we need to have as our starting point the politics of self-emancipation of the working class. So that is the absolute crucial element in how socialists orient to any revolutionary struggle. I've got noted down here, love not hate, which sounds like some appalling hippie slogan. But actually, if you look at the politics of any revolutionary movement when it emerges and the way that the different forces in society relate to that, it very much does come down to a question of love and hate. Because almost all of the reformist forces in society, the political organisations of the old order and so on, hate revolutionary upheavals. They often have to pretend that they like them, but on a fundamental level, they hate them. And you saw that in Egypt in 2011, whether it was Mubarak or whether it was the Muslim Brotherhood or whether it was the various liberal organisations and so on, some of which wanted to oppose Mubarak and were forced to say they supported the revolution. But at every single stage, every single phase in that revolution, they were terrified of the mass movement. They were terrified of the struggle. They were terrified of the chaos of ordinary people rising up and taking control out of the hands of the existing institutions and putting it into their own hands. So the most fundamental thing that you need in a revolutionary situation is organisations of people who think that the struggle, far from being something to be feared, is the thing that can liberate humanity, is the thing that can fundamentally transform things in the interests of the rest of us. There was a famous slogan from the uprising in May 1968 in France, which said that beauty is in the street. And that is, I think, a profound slogan in terms of understanding, what is the dividing line between the revolutionary forces or the forces that want to take things forward and all the reactionary ones. The people who think that there's beauty in the street, that there's beauty in the struggle, that the chaos that is unleashed by people trying to organise to change things, that is the engine or that can drive our society forward. So that is, I think, the first crucial element of the kind of politics that socialists need to take into revolutionary situations. The second thing I think that is necessary is organisations of people who are fighters and people who want to lead on the ground. You think of the way that most political organisations in society organise. And I know I see a lot of the Labor Party people because I work at Trades Hall. And around there they come in and they do their door knocking and organise their door knocking and their phone banking and all these kind of things to get out the vote for the Labor Party in the election. Now, aside from what's wrong with that politically, i.e. there's not much point in getting the Labor Party elected, that election's not going to really change anything. But, the kind of people that they're building out of this kind of activity are people who think that you just need to ring up people and lie to them a little bit or convince them, how to vote and so on. There's nothing about how do you actually organise people to be able to fight for a better world. How do you convince people to, take a risk, to go out on strike, to organise other people around them. We need an organisation of people who can lead others in struggle, help to organise them, help to give them confidence and help with the arguments that they need to overcome, whether it's the boss that they're fighting or the government or whatever. And that means, I think, that we need an organisation that's built of and oriented to young people and workers. Because you look at any revolutionary struggle, and the Arab Revolution was no exception in this regard. Any revolutionary struggle, the youth are always in the vanguard, and the working class, whether they come into activity, whether they come to the front of the struggle, is the crucial element in whether a revolution goes forward or not. And so I think any socialist organisation needs to focus on those two elements, because they're the dynamic elements of any mass struggle and the decisive factor in whether they go forward or backwards. I think if you're going to have a revolutionary organisation in a revolution, it needs to be one that is schooled in the history and the theory of the Marxist movement. There can be a lot of talk, and there often is, with particularly when we're talking about things like how do you relate to Sanders and how do we build something in a very non-revolutionary situation that we find ourselves in Australia or the US and so on today, to say, well, all the the lessons of history, the revolutions that were happening in 1917, the strategic and tactical arguments of the socialist movement and so on, well, they don't seem to have all that much relevance to what's going on today. When the revolution broke out in 2011 in the Arab world, all of those arguments came immediately back to the fore. The question of state power, how you relate to it, how do you confront it? The question of liberal political organisations that have a hold over the masses, how should socialists relate to those? How do they challenge them? The question of how to relate to the armed forces. The question of how to relate to the middle class. The question of the seizure of power, of setting up new institutions of workers' organisation and so on. All of these questions that are the questions that have preoccupied socialists for the last 100 years when they've looked at the lessons of revolutionary struggles, all of those came immediately to the fore. It was Marxist politics came into its element. And, we like to think that Marxists can explain any social phenomena and have an analysis of even the most mundane thing in society. But it is the case that in revolutionary struggles, the politics of Marxism come to life in a way that, they do at no other time. And if people look back at so the things that we wrote and the things that other Marxists wrote during the 2011 uprising, they're some of the best things we've ever written. And the reason was that in those revolutions, we saw everything that we said about how society can change come to the fore. So everyone else pretty much in the world, the writers for the New York Times and the Middle East analysts and think tanks and so on, were utterly confused and disoriented and thrown by what happened. But what we were able to do was come out and say, this has vindicated what Marxists have said all along about how liberation can be won, and these are the things that we need to do now if we're going to take it forward. And the most crucial argument that we made at the time was it's not enough to just overthrow a dictator, that actually the movement's going to succeed. It's going to need to develop into a social revolution that rips apart the whole of the state apparatus of the old regimes in the Middle East. Now, that didn't happen, but that's the great tragedy, and that's why those revolutions have so far not succeeded. So an organisation that's rooted in the history, in the theory of Marxism and the workers' movement is absolutely crucial in any revolutionary struggle. Okay. The other element I would say about the kind of organisation you need in a revolutionary struggle is precisely because it's about organising the people who want to fight the system, the people who want to rip the head off the system, that has to be what a revolutionary party is. It can't be a bunch of armchair socialists, academics, and so on. It's got to be the people who want to get out on the streets and fight and lead others to fight alongside them. Well, any organisation like that is going to be full of people who aren't terribly willing to be told what to do. You know, the idea of some, you know, party organisation, socialist organisation, where the leadership just tell the members what to do and they sort of, you know, meekly take it like sheep and so on, or an organisation where you're not allowed to have any dissent, where you're not allowed to have any arguments and so on. Such an organisation will be one that has no capacity to relate to a revolutionary struggle, because a revolutionary struggle is about, and a revolutionary organisation in that struggle is about bringing together the people who want to fight the system, and they're going to fight each other as well. You have arguments about what to do, arguments about which way to go forward. You're going to have, you know, personalities, like, you know, iconoclastic people who aren't just going to be, you know, directed, I'll do this and do that because I say so. So you need an organisation and a culture that is democratic, that is argumentative, and all the rest of it, if you're going to have any chance of holding together in the throes of revolution. Okay, but as I said at the start, or as is probably clear to people, we're very far here from, in Australia, from anything like the kind of revolutionary struggles that really, you know, put socialist organisations to the fire. But the reality is that we can't wait for such a situation to emerge, because, you know, the reality is that when that happens, you end up with organisations that are way too small and incapable of relating to anything, regardless of how good their ideas are and how militant their fighters are and so on. And so we need to build in every situation that we can to try and build, create the kind of organisations that we need. And I think most of the time, or a lot of the time, the way to do that will be to build directly. And that's what Socialist Alternative mostly does, is go out and try and recruit people to Marxism, to socialism, to the idea of working class revolution, and to the idea of, you know, we need a party that can lead that lead that revolution sometime in the future. And that will be, I think, you know, it's got to be the bread and butter of any strategy for trying to build. But as well, it is necessary to try and intersect with every positive development, however limited, in society. And that can be whether you're talking about strikes, whether you're talking about the formation of new political currents, or, you know, the formation of new social movements, and so on. And so I think for that reason, however strong our criticisms are and however much we see the limitations of the new reformist politics that I talked about at the beginning, it's incumbent on socialists where we can, and, you know, we don't have this opportunity so much in Australia at the moment, to actually go out and try and relate to those and try and win some of those people at least to a broader and more thoroughgoing socialist project. Now, we've had a number of discussions in Socialist Alternative, and we're having debates about, you know, exactly how positive is what's happening in the United States, or what does it represent, and, you know, how much should socialists try to relate to that, and how exactly should you do that. But I think we do have broad agreement that socialists should relate to something like the Sanders phenomenon or over in Britain to what's happened with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. But I think there's a number of things about how we do that that are really important. And I think the most crucial one is that we approach any more right-wing political currents with absolute brutal honesty ourselves about what we think they are. That the road to the first step down the road to disaster is to try and paint lipstick on a pig to say that, you know, oh, well, because we were trying to relate to this thing, and other people have illusions in it, then therefore we have to, you know, pretend that it's something that it's not. We have to paint lipstick on a pig. And I think especially this is the case in a situation where we're talking about the electoral, essentially just electoral projects of Sanders and of Corbyn, where essentially they're not involved in building any, you know, movements on the ground, not building any union struggles, not building any, you know, strike movements or anything like that. They're essentially electoral terrain, which is, you know, in a lot of ways, terrain that we have to fight on, but some of the worst terrain for socialists to organise. And it's often put that the new era that we're in of the last few years, the electoral terrain has become, you know, much more crucially important for socialists to engage in than ever before, partly because, you know, the lack of confidence of people to go and strike and organise on the ground and so on. That, you know, electoral politics is a crucial thing that socialists need to pay more attention to. And look, that may or may not be the case. I think it's not proven yet, you know, how things are going to develop, whether we're at the beginning of a new era of socialist electoral challenges or whether that will, you know, move very quickly into some other arena of struggle. We don't know. But I tell you what, if it is the case that the electoral arena has become more important, that means that the kind of organisations that revolutionary socialists need to build have to be harder and much more clear about you know, what that terrain is, about the limitations of it, and about the problems with reformist politics. And I think that, you know, in a way, and I'll get on to the Victorian socialists in a sec, that's the determining factor into how much you can relate to some more right-wing formation. That the more that you have a coherent, organised group of socialists who know what they're doing, who are going in there with a clear argument, and so on, the more concessions you can make, in the sense that, you know, you can go in and not worry as much about just becoming, you know, immersed in that project, and, you know, all of your membership, you know, riding off to the right and just all to become electoral campaigners and reformists. And that's, I want to move on to the Victorian socialists now. That is very much the attitude that we in Socialist Alternative had when it came to the Victorian socialists. Now, just on the Victorian socialists, I think it's the case that most of what socialists around the world are going to be doing in the sort of period that we're now starting to enter is not themselves going out to try and establish, you know, sort of broad left electoral formations. That actually, we've seen what happened with the Labour Party in Britain and in the United States, that this was not, you know, these phenomena were not driven by revolutionary socialists or anything like it. And that's part of the reason that they've got such a, you know, a mass appeal. But actually, here in Australia, we're not saying we're going to, you know, replicate what Sanders did or what Corbyn did in terms of some, you know, mass national phenomenon that takes over politics. But in a modest way, I think it is reasonable to say that it's some of the same arguments that we're putting forward. Essentially, we're trying to build an electoral campaign, an electoral force that puts itself up as being an alternative to the neoliberal consensus, that puts itself up standing on the, you know, some of the most basic terrain, like opposition to privatisation and so on, is a rejection of what the Labor Party has been and where it's gone over the last 40 years, and also a rejection of the totally classless politics of the Australian Greens. So we're trying to do that. But the reason that Socialist Alternative was reasonably confident to go out and throw ourselves in, as we did last year and as we're doing again now, into essentially going around door knocking and trying to get people to vote for a broad socialist ticket, which is very far from trying to figure out how to organise a revolutionary struggle to overthrow capitalism. The reason we were confident to do that was that we were reasonably confident in our own organisation and its capacity to do that without then, you know, all just liquidating to the right and just becoming reformists and so on. And this is not some idea we dreamt up. This is the one of the first people who talked about this was actually Lenin, talking in the 1905 revolution. And he was talking about, I think he was talking about the setting up the Soviets. Yeah, it was the Soviets. Anyway, he's talking about what he said, that the danger may be said to lie in a sudden influx of large numbers of social democrats into the party. I know this was just about opening up the party, that's right. And he wrote, if that occurred, the party, people said, would be dissolved among the masses. It would cease to be the conscious vanguard of the class. Its role would be reduced to that of a tail. That would mean a very deplorable period indeed. And this danger could undoubtedly be a very serious one if we showed any inclination towards demagogy, if we lacked party principles, or if those principles were feeble and shaky. But the fact is that no such ifs existed. We have a firmly established party program which is officially recognised by all social democrats, and the fundamental propositions of which have not given rise to any criticism. So what he's saying is the Bolshevik party was able to expand massively to draw in all new layers of workers who weren't necessarily, you know, revolutionaries, some of whom could be more right-wing. They could do that on the basis that the party that they had going into that was firmly established, was unwavering, you know, had principles and had people trained in those principles. But that's what gave them the ability to massively expand, which is what they did go on to do. And that, you know, that was the attitude we took in. Not that we want to put ourselves up as being like the Russian Bolsheviks or anything like it, but that idea that we had a firmly established group of people who were clear, well, we're not going to change the world by getting a socialist elected to parliament, but this is something that we want to do to both help the struggle now and to lay the basis for broader revolutionary organisation in the future. Without that premise, I think we would have already liquidated ourselves into the Victorian socialists and, you know, into just broad electoral campaigning. So in that context, yeah, I think how we position ourselves is important. Daniel Lopez said yesterday in the session that I referred to earlier that Jeremy gave that, well, maybe at the moment we don't want to raise the banner of revolutionary politics, that, you know, because it's sort of something for the future. It's not immediately what we're talking about. The question of whether we actually have a revolution in Australia is not what's posed by, you know, the immediate challenge of how the socialists organise today and the Vic socialists or whatever we do. I think it's crucially important that we do raise the banner of revolutionary politics, because it's precisely by doing that that we give ourselves the tactical and strategic flexibility to actually, you know, organise on a much wider basis without any the danger of abandoning the politics, the core of which we hold altogether. I've sort of talked about, well, you need a hard organisation to, you know, so you don't sort of sell your soul when you engage in some broader project. And this isn't just about electoral politics. This is about doing trade union work, or, you know, pretty much most spheres of struggle involve pressures to, you know, adapt to your right. So partly you want a hard organisation so that it doesn't capitulate to those things. But I think one of the really clear lessons we learnt from the Victorian Socialists last year is actually having an organisation of dedicated revolutionaries is crucial to making something like the Victorian Socialists work. We knocked on 90,000 doors in about a 7-week period at the end of last year. Our student members in particular, workers as well, went out day after day after day, handing out, you know, how to vote cards, talking to people, standing on the booths, and so on. The energy of our campaigners was massively more than of any of the other, you know, the Greens or the Labor Party or anybody else. That our members would argue with people, talk to them, butt in the way of the, you know, the other campaigners, you know, be there after the rest of them had given up and gone home. Now, I do not believe that the reason that they all did that was that they thought it was so important just to get one socialist elected to the parliament. The reason that we were able to mobilise our organisation to carry out that campaign was precisely because that campaign was part of a broader vision. It was part of an, you know, the people doing it did it because they were committed to the transformation of society in a fundamental level, not because we wanted to win a state election. And for that reason, when we didn't, you know, we got a good vote, we didn't, for various reasons, get over the line, people didn't collapse in dismay at that, because precisely of that, that they saw it as part of a broader struggle to change society. And so I think that's, you know, that's absolutely crucial and points to the future of the Victorian Socialists, that actually I think continuing to build socialist alternative and build, you know, cadres of people who understand Marxism, understand history, are committed fighters, you know, in the workplace or on their campuses and so on, this is absolutely crucial to the future of any, you know, broad electoral project as well. Okay. All right, I'll just to finish up. I think the other thing about the thing I want to finish on is the importance of building in the difficult times. And it's doubtlessly the case that, you know, it's a difficult time here at the moment, that it's not, you know, the most inspiring every day to go out and fight for socialism and so on. But I think, you know, I talked about the Arab revolutions as an example of, you know, the inspiring moment when all seems possible. And clearly there, one of the crucial lessons was, you know, there weren't enough socialists to start with. And the main socialist organisation in Egypt, which I went there just after the fall of Mubarak in 2011, had a couple of hundred people. And, you know, over the next few years, the weight coming down of all the struggle that happened basically busted that organisation apart. And the crucial reason, that they were a pack of brilliant socialists. And the reason that they weren't able to break out was not anything to do with the limits of their politics or the, you know, the limits of the passions or the capacities of the people involved. There just weren't enough of them. You know, to relate to a movement that was moving millions of people, you couldn't do it with a few hundred. You needed thousands if you were going to then use that moment to go from thousands to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of supporters. So that's the crucial argument. In my own much narrower experience than the Egyptian Revolution, probably the high point from a struggle point of view of my political life was in 2000 when it was the anti-corporate movement, we called it at the time. And sort of out of nowhere, it seemed to come. We had 20 to 30,000 people down at the, actually just around here, just around the corner here, down at the Crown Casino, blockading a forum that was the World Economic Forum, a forum of some of the, you know, what we now call the 1%, the billionaire class. And there were 20 to 25,000 people there, and we stopped them from getting in. And it was the closest thing I've seen to, you know, an insurgence anywhere. Down on Clarendon Street, we had probably 5 to 10,000 people blockading, you know, the buses. There were helicopters flying in overhead. We pushed police officers, hundreds of them, right down the road, drove them, you know, basically nearly into the Yarra. It was a moment of incredible, you know, where you felt that anything was possible. The class struggle was real, and that, you know, even in sleepy old little Melbourne, it was possible for masses of people to rise up and take on the powerful and challenge them, not just in a protest, but actually, you know, drive the representatives and the defenders of the ruling class off the streets. That was an amazing moment that really crystallised for a lot of, you know, myself and a lot of other people who were there, the crucial, you know, need for revolution and the possibility of ordinary people to rise up and change things. But the reality was that out of that, you know, the socialist forces at the time, Socialist Alternative, we had about 40 members. You know, none of the forces of the revolutionary left were big enough there to take advantage of that galvanising moment. And so you had a situation where, I think largely because of that, and there's other factors as well, over the next few years, the energy of that movement, you know, dissipated away. And, you know, a lot of people, younger people here, probably haven't even heard of the S11 protests in 2011. So that, I think, is a real argument that when those things are happening, it's obvious why you need to build a socialist organisation, why you need one, because you want one to be able to do the things that you see how it could be done with an organisation. That's not the case most of the time. But actually, the day-to-day nitty-gritty stuff of trying to recruit new people to socialist organisation and doing all the things that are so unrevolutionary, you know, it can seem ludicrous. You know, knocking on doors and saying, you know, we're going to, you know, build a cross-town bus, you know, route and so on, can seem like this is so far from the idea of insurrection. Or the things that the students do, negotiating in the student unions to work out like electoral tickets to run and try and get the education officer of NUS or the student, you know, this can seem so mundane in one level, and doing all of these, you know, little tiny things, but it's doing whatever you can at any given time to build up the power step by step by step, you know, and being prepared to suck it up and say, well, this might not seem, you know, heroic, this might not seem inspired, but it's necessary and it's what we can do to build the forces that we can now so that when we have opportunities to do the heroic things, we've actually got the forces that can have some capacity to do that and to make a real difference to the social struggle.